Jell-O brand pudding puffs, new chocolate vanilla swirl.
Poems is not the way you're going to get your woman back. What you need to do now is go to the next level if you want Justine back.
What's that?
Begging. You need to do some serious begging. And I mean other than the begging you've been doing where you say, Justine, I'm sorry. And Justine, well, it wasn't me that you saw, you know, that kind of thing. You need to do some serious get down underneath. Please, please, please.
I think we all recognize that voice. He was a pitchman for Jell-O, and he got us moving with Fat Albert. He was the first black man to star in a television drama, and he gave fatherly advice in another TV show that bore his name and changed the way many people in America viewed African Americans. Bill Cosby, of course, is a stand-up comedian who reveres Jonathan Winters, and he's a humanitarian to boot. He's also a very complicated human being who works harder to make his comedy work than it looks like on the outside. Former Newsweek editor Mark Whitaker has written a new biography of Bill Cosby titled simply Cosby, His Life and Times. Mark will be in town on Thursday night to speak at the library. More on that in just a moment. And Mark, so good to have you. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
You tell a great story about the incident that shaped Bill Cosby's comedic style, which, you know, emphasizes storytelling over just fast quips. What happened there?
So this was back in the early 60s.
Yeah.
He was a student at Temple University, and he was just starting to experiment with comedy. First as a bartender, he would tell jokes while he was tending bar, and then he got a couple of gigs performing in a little nightclub next door. And he was kind of trying all kinds of different things, stealing jokes from other comedians. One night he goes out to grab a quick bite at a Chinese restaurant, and he sees a table full of people who are just laughing their heads off, and he starts paying attention. And he realizes that they're all listening to one person, a man who isn't telling jokes but is telling stories. But the stories are funny, and he's telling them in such a funny way that that everybody at the table, you know, just can't stop laughing. And this image sticks in his mind for weeks after that. And he decides then and there, before anybody even knew who Bill Cosby was, that that's what the style of comedy he wanted to do. He didn't want to be a joke teller. He wanted to be a storyteller who made his stories funny.
Well, today he divides his material, and I just love this, into two categories, gourmet meals and fast food. What's the distinction there?
Well, this was when I spent a weekend traveling.
Yes.
With him. You know, he's still on the road all the time, performs 60-plus concerts a year. And I was interviewing him and asking him about, you know, how he constructed his routines. And he said that basically he has – his long stories are what he calls gourmet meals, that he may not get a laugh a minute. But they draw people in, and he can go on for sometimes, you know, 20 minutes in one story, and people are getting the payoff of, you know, this very vivid detail, and then laughing along the way, and usually at the end they have a deep sense of satisfaction. But he admitted that some nights he has to throw in a little bit more of what he calls fast foods, which are sort of quick jokes and lines that are always sure to get a laugh. And he makes that decision. You know, no concert that he gives is the same. And he'll make a decision on the fly based on the audience and the mood of the place, you know, how much of it is going to be gourmet and how much of it is going to be fast food.
I also liked what he said about how he describes the process of putting together a new bit. He calls it loading the boat. What is that?
Well, you know, when he started out, he would write out bits, and actually he first had an inkling that he, you know, could be a comedian. He had always been a funny guy who made his friends laugh. But when he was in a remedial English class at Temple University in Philadelphia, he barely got into college. He had dropped out of high school. His SATs were terrible. He was in remedial English, and the professor gave him an assignment of writing essays. And he wrote these funny little essays about losing his first tooth and sharpening pencils to procrastinate when he had to do his homework. And so he started writing, and his first comedic bits he had written out. But later, he developed a process, once he became really well known, in order to develop new material, he would start with just a comic idea. and he would work it in the midst of already well-established routines. Mm-hmm. And if he got a laugh, then the next night he would add a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more until he had a full-blown routine. So some of all the routines that he's famous for, Noah, the dentist, to Russell, my brother, who I slept with, about sleeping the same with his brother, those were all developed on stage night after night as he they got longer and longer and more involved until they were sort of, you know, finished and perfect.
Just how important is this man, Mark?
Well, you know, this is why I was interested in writing a book about him. Obviously, he's been a pioneer in all these areas, and you described it very well in your introduction. But also, I think he's someone who has had a huge social impact. And I think after, obviously the great, political figures and civil rights figures, I think he is one of the most influential African Americans of the last half century. And the interesting thing about it is that for most of his career, with the exception of the last 10 years, he sort of did it without pushing racial buttons. In fact, he did it by using the medium first of comedy albums and then the even more powerful medium of television to help people see that they had more in common than they had differences.
Hmm. The I Spy role alongside Robert Culp, and this is the role where he became the first black man to star in a television drama, it almost never happened because Bill Cosby was so wooden in front of a camera, in the way he acted. And this was in the early going of the show. Who ended up saving Bill Cosby and then eventually his career, Mark?
Well, at that time, the show debuted in 1965. There were no African-Americans on primetime television. So when Sheldon Leonard, the producer, decided that he wanted to do the spy show featuring a team that one would be white, one would be black, he didn't have a lot of options. He looked around, and Cosby's career as a comedian was just taking off. And he kind of looked at him and he said, this guy has a quality. I think he could really be successful. So he casts him. But then Cosby, who had no acting experience, initially is terrible in the table reads and the pilot. And NBC, the network, wanted to replace him. And basically, he only held on because Leonard stood up for him. But even more importantly, Robert Culp threatened to quit if Cosby. And then, having saved Cosby, he insisted that their roles be 50-50. On the show, and they developed this great off-screen friendship, but also, this great rapport on screen. And ironically, Cosby was the one who, for three consecutive years, the 3 years that show was on the air, won Emmys for acting in the same category as Culp.
He figured it out pretty quickly. I mean, Culp actually helped teach him acting too, didn't he?
That's right. Culp was considered himself quite a serious actor, and he had gone to acting school in New York, and he sort of showed him a lot of the techniques that he had learned. But also, probably even more significantly, Culp was a writer, and Culp decided that he didn't like a lot of the scripts that were being produced for the show. So he decided himself to write a half dozen episodes, which are now, if you go back, are among the best episodes of that show for those three seasons. And all of those episodes gave a major role to Cosby's character, Alexander Scott, including, for the first time, allowing him to have a romantic interest on the show, which is something that, other writers probably, if it hadn't been for Bob Culp, that never would have happened.
Robert Culp sounds like a tremendous human being.
Yeah, no, I think he was, and it's really interesting because they had a term for it, that their statement about race relations was going to be a non-statement, that just by being partners on screen, showing how comfortable they were with each other, that in and of itself would have a huge impact.
Former Newsweek editor Mark Whitaker is my guest. He has a new biography out of Bill Cosby. It's titled simply Cosby, His Life and Times. And Mark will be in town at the Central Library at 6:30 Thursday evening. That's at 14 West 10th Street. To RSVP and grab a seat, just go to kclibrary.org. Well, let's fast forward a few years, Mark, because whose idea was it to star Bill Cosby as Dr. Cliff Huxtable on The Cosby Show?
Well, again, this is an interesting story, particularly given how successful that show was. The fact was that Cosby, after I Spy, except for Fat Albert, his Saturday morning cartoon show, had not been successful on television for almost a decade and a half. He had had three primetime shows that had failed. His comedy albums weren't selling anymore. He was mostly known by the early 80s as you know, an advertising guy. But he had started in the late 70s, around the time that he turns 40, changing the focus of his stand-up routine from the young guy talking about his funny childhood to the stories of a middle-aged man struggling with the joys and the frustrations of being a parent, because at that point he and his wife had five kids. And he does a concert film for the first time in 1983, Bill Cosby himself, which is, you know, mostly focused on that material. And two young producers in Hollywood have gone out on their own, Marcy Carsey and Tom Warner, see this, and they say that we need to create a sitcom based on this. Now, again, at the time, sitcoms were dead. You know, there were no sitcoms, you know, at the top of the ratings. People, you know, thought that the form was extinct. ABC passed on the show. They didn't have time to do a pilot. It was cast in a matter of weeks. And, you know, it almost didn't happen. And the idea that at that time, a show, you know, against all of those odds, and also a show, you know, about a black family would almost instantly become the hottest show on television was something that nobody foresaw until it went on the air.
And the show, Mark, worked so well. Why?
Well, you know, I think I call the show quietly radical.
Mm-hmm.
For a couple of reasons. One was Cosby, and he had to fight very hard for this, insisted that the show be realistic and the stories be realistic. He didn't want anything, you know, kind of classic setup jokes and easy laugh lines. And he even hired his friend Alvin Poussaint, a prominent African-American psychiatrist from Harvard, to vet the scripts for psychological realism. So as a result, it was a show that, although it was very funny, people thought it was very real. And people of all races and all backgrounds could identify with the family dynamics on that show. But at the same time, it's interesting because it was criticized at the time, and some people remember it as a show that really didn't have that the Huxtables could have been white. They weren't really sort of a genuinely, you know, authentic African-American family. But in fact, for African-American viewers, they saw in the background of that show a tremendous amount of celebration of black culture, of jazz, of black art, of, you know, the role of Hillman, the historically black college. So the fact that Cosby sort of had the vision to create a show that sort of was universal on the one level, but also was, you know, had this sort of aspirational message for the black community is really quite remarkable.
You know, it's amazing because you watch the show and you see a man who's in such great harmony with his family, his wife and his kids, and yet in Bill Cosby's personal life, there's been a whole host of personal setbacks, and some of these were absolutely devastating. Tell us about the loss of his son, and then he had an estrangement from one of his daughters as well.
Right. So had five children, as the Huxtables have on the show, and there are a lot of details of the Huxtable family that really come from Cosby's life. Four daughters and one son, as on the show. His son, Ennis, was, you know, Cosby, he was the apple of Cosby's eye, but he struggled for many years in school. And this was a great source of frustration to his father, and they actually came to blows a couple of times over it. He was so concerned that Ennis wasn't taking his schoolwork seriously. Finally, when Ennis is a undergraduate at Morehouse College in Atlanta, he gets diagnosed with dyslexia, and he goes to a special school to learn learning skills, and ends up graduating on the dean's list and goes to Columbia Teachers College to get a doctorate in education. And while he's studying there, he goes to L.A. On vacation, and in this awful random thing, he gets a flat tire on the San Diego freeway, pulls over, is changing his tire in the middle of the night when this young delinquent who sees him driving, you know, changing the tire of this fancy Mercedes convertible that belonged to his parents, probably in a robbery attempt, shoots him dead.
Mm.
It's something in our talk. I can't, describe all the ways in which it affected his father, but suffice it to say that you'll see in the book that a lot of, I think, what you see in Cosby, the fact that he's still out there working so diligently, the fact that he's talking so passionately about education and so forth to this day, a lot of that has to do with giving meaning to this awful tragedy. And then just briefly, his daughter is the height of the Cosby Show. He had his second daughter was having all kinds of problems, dropped out of school, developed a drug habit. The family basically, in a kind of tough love exercise, cut her off, and they were estranged. She had very little to do with her parents for almost a decade. And actually, in a very poignant thing, it was the death of her brother Ennis that brought her back into the family. And now she's incredibly close with her parents.
His wife Camille has been an absolute rock for him, Mark, even in a professional sense. Tell us about Camille Hanks Cosby.
Well, it's very interesting. They met. Cosby's career was just starting out. He was 26 years old. She was 19. She was still an undergraduate at the University of Maryland, and she came in the sort of segregated black world of the time. She came from a much higher social caste than he did. And she was beautiful and so forth. She was a tremendous catch for somebody like Cosby, particularly in a day before he, everybody knew he was going to be as successful as he was. And, she's a very private person, someone who has not only had a huge role in raising their children, but has been a behind-the-scenes advisor to him throughout his career. There was a point in the early 70s when, having made a lot of money with his comedy albums and I Spy, he sank it all into a production company with his manager who screwed it up, and he came within $50,000 of being flat broke.
Mm.
And they had to move from Hollywood, and they rebased in Western Massachusetts where he was going to graduate school and education. And he basically turned over supervision of the family finances to Camille, which continues to this day. And another interesting story, when they were developing The Cosby Show, and there was some debate between Cosby and the producers about what kind of profession the stars, the characters should have. And originally, Cosby had an idea that his character should be a limo driver and his wife should be a carpenter or a plumber. And the producers felt, no, it would be funnier if they're professionals who consider themselves very intelligent and have advanced degrees and they still are tearing their hair out about dealing with their kids. Camille was the one who sided with the producers and said, Bill, they're right, you should do it that way. And that's how we ended up with Cliff and Claire Huxtable.
Great story. Mark Whitaker, again, is our guest. His new biography of Bill Cosby is titled simply Cosby, His Life and Times. Again, he appears at 6:30 on Thursday evening at the Central Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. To grab a seat, kclibrary.org. We have an email here from Regine in Lawrence who asked this, Mark. Is there any truth to the accusations of his sexual transgressions or abuse of women? What can you tell us about that?
Well, this is something that ultimately I did not address in the book for the very simple reason that although there have been these accusations, I didn't feel like I had enough independent reporting or corroboration to address them in the book. There were no definitive court rulings, no police evidence, and no independent witnesses. And I felt, particularly in a book that I never intended to be fundamentally about his private life, that what I did include about his private life, I wanted to be sure that I knew for sure that what I described had happened. And I do deal in the book with his infidelity and relations with other women and the effect that that had on his marriage at certain points. But in the cases where I felt like I could not go beyond just reprinting allegations that hadn't been conclusively confirmed, I just didn't feel in a book that, you know, I hope will stand the test of time, that it was fair to include those.
You know, you were the first African-American to head up a major news weekly in this country, and I'm wondering if you were able to identify with Bill Cosby in some ways, given the fact that you, too, were a groundbreaker, Mark.
Yeah, well, you know, I think so. I mean, you know, look, I mean, I had sort of two impulses in writing this book. I mean, on the one hand, I personally was a fan. He had been someone who was actually personally meaningful to me, first as a kid growing up in the 60s, and then in the 80s as someone sort of starting a family and watching that show and seeing it sort of as a model for family life. And I, you know, I also, I think, had some appreciation of, you know, after the fact, it's very easy to see when people are successful, you know, and to sort of think it was all inevitable. But, you know, Cosby, you know, had to fight very hard for all of, you know, the breakthroughs mm-hmm. that he made, for the amount of time that he got on air and the dignity of the Alexander Scott character on I Spy, for the Fat Albert show, for and also in the development of the Cosby Show, and you know, he's also been someone who has been, you know, a huge philanthropist,
yeah.
Particularly around the cause of education off screen. So yeah, no, I mean, I identified with all of that, but I also felt as a journalist that it was also incumbent on me to be, you know, as objective as possible. So, you know, I deal with some of the more unpleasant aspects of his personality and how tough he's been and the ways in which he's not a perfect person. But, you know, but in a way, I think that makes the story more interesting because, you know, ultimately, I think you come away from the book, you know, you can decide after you read it what you think of him, but there's no question that he's had a huge impact. And also that, in a way, you can identify with him because, you know, he's had a lot of the struggles that a lot of us have in addition to all of his success.
Well, I wish we could have gone on for even longer, Mark. I enjoyed this conversation so much. That's Mark Whitaker. Again, his new book on Bill Cosby, Cosby, His Life and Times. I sure enjoyed it, Mark. Thanks for the time.
Okay, and I'm looking forward to being in Kansas City.
We'll see you on Thursday. You bet.